Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 31st, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Dorte Zola. Today's session number is 98-4, and it is titled, Allah Has 100 Names. Let's listen in.
Last session for this week, mysticism and resistance, and I go next week on with the same theme but different forms of lectures and talks. And I thought of starting this with reading to you a prayer based on the 90th psalm, which all of you will know, I think, and I thought it might be often in the last years learned to interrupt my theological or intellectual discourse through other forms of language, namely prayer or poems, poetry. I think it helps us to understand better what we really try to say. Now this is this prayer based on the 90th psalm. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth and the oceans, before our little blue planet on which life multiplies for love and union, was born from you after a long pregnancy. You were there, waiting for us. You allow cultures to perish when they separate from you and call others into being. What seemed to us 1,000 years and unchanging, the bloody violence, is to you a short watch in the night. Even tyrants break down exhausted. Economic conglomerates dissolve, and the knowledge of infallible parties becomes last year's snow. Slavery was profitable and flourished, but in the evening of your day it withered. The fruits of armament climbed to the sky, but your anger consumed them, and your wrath will destroy the stolen prosperity. You make known our plundering of the poor. You bring to light our veiled crimes. Our days pass away quickly in fear of the truth. We spend our years as if on a drug trip. Our life here, 70 years, other lands, many will not live even 4 years. Here we push 80 and more, but joy has become stale. Technology drags us along. Who has faith in you, poor God, without nuclear bombs and without banks? And who is afraid when your fish die? Remind us that we are small, dwelling here briefly on borrowed earth. Teach us that we must die and have no time for all the hatred that makes our low-flying plans whole. Teach us to number the days in which we think of you and call upon you. Turn your countenance to us, O God. Come to those who watch for you. Satisfy us in the morning with your light, so that we make music and no day is without joy. Make us glad again after all the years of emptiness in the land of Brutus, where blood cleaves to our bank palaces. Lilas, bread and roses, O God. Your splendor in the hair of children. Let your light be upon us, making it easy for us to come and to go. Help us preserve your world and establish the work of our hands, the good work of liberation. The theme of today is that Allah has 100 names, but only 99 are known. It's a wonderful phrase. It comes from the Sufi tradition, the mystical tradition of the Muslims. Several Sufi have spoken this way. Now the Quran begins all its surahs with the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Powerful, who is in the thunderstorm or whatever. It's always a name of God in the beginning. But this remark of the Sufis that Allah has 100 names, but we only know 99, can be interpreted in two different ways. One is, and they are not contradictory, they're not exclusive. The one is that it's up to you to find the 100th name of God. It's up to us to learn to find a name of God we need, and maybe God needs, a name which really expresses that what we feel about God. And I think this is a good exercise to think about a name of God on this morning, the name I wish to give to God. Because one of the Jewish rabbis say that we crown God in our prayers. And I was very surprised to read this, because in the Lutheran tradition it's always God who crowns maybe us if we are good and faithful, etc. But that we crown God is a wonderful sort of overwhelming expression of our love to God. And mysticism is a name of our love we bring forward to God. The other thing, how we could interpret this, Allah has 100 names but only 99 are known, would be to say that one name is always missing, because no one knows the otherness of the other completely. Let me explain this a little bit in loving relationships. When people meet and come closer and come together, and if you imagine them as each of them as a circle or a full moon, let's say it this way, they come closer and they love each other and they name each other and they invent wonderful new names. That's part of what love is all about, telling the other, you are my violin concerto, A major, or something like that. Oh, you are an awful, terrible person. You can say these things in very many different ways, I think. But naming each other is an important, it's play and it's serious, it's both. And this is an important business, I think. And when we fail to name each other, I think we lose something of this ongoing love. When we think we know each other, then maybe the marriage has become stale and boring. But when this goes on, then we are free to experience the other in new forms. But our names never cover completely who the other is. And there is, when going back to this image of these two moons coming closer to each other, coming closer, and a lot of things, maybe the center even, is one. Both get together, but there's still a little half moon which is left over on both sides of any relationship. There is still a little bit we don't know or don't name or in which we are not together. Me, for example, I tried always to convince my husband that jazz is a wonderful way of making music, but he is so far away from it that he never touched it, so it's one of our half moons. Maybe he has much worse things I never touch, being not a good cook or whatever. So we have many, many half moons around, and they change, of course, like all half moons do. And there are many of them. This is even more so with our relationship towards God, that there is still this half moon we don't know. We have not yet named. Maybe there is no name for that. Maybe the names are wrong. Something is wrong with our naming God. Especially when we claim that our names are the only names. And when we think, for example, I recall when the feminist Christian movement tried to open up the Our Father into an Our Father and Mother, Our God in Heaven, that some people were really frightened and said, this is not what Jesus said, and so this is not, and we said, but if this is what Jesus meant, but they didn't want to hear that, so we got really into fighting about those names, and I still think we need those fights. They're very useful, because we learn to love God better when we fight about names. And think about some exclusive names which would forbid other names. And when we teach our children a little bit about God, telling them stories, they sometimes invent names. The other day when I told you this little story of my granddaughter Johanna, who said, I was hidden in God when I was not yet born, and I hadn't thought about God in this moment, and she said this. So God being a hiding place is a wonderful name of God. And she brought it forward. So we learn always to go a step farther, and I think that is a very important thing. And it would be a childish way to stick to only some few names. It would reduce our love of God to something which is not enough, or which is limited. But God isn't limited. And to limit God to only some names is a limitation which cannot be tolerated really in this. I think this is something mysticism teaches us, that we have to overcome the limitations and come here from the borderline into the center and come closer to the center. And that means that we maybe don't find all the 99 names of Allah, but maybe find some at least. And in that, on this way, I think we, naming the Beloved, leads us closer into union with the Beloved. And becoming one with the Beloved. Claude was telling me the other day something about St. Francis of Assisi. He was going to the world and went to a river and told the river, "Tell me about God. What have you to tell me, river?" And then the river had a little pool, a pond, and in that St. Francis discovered the face of his beloved Clara, the woman he loved. And he saw Clara in this pool, and he saw God, and he loved more. And then he went on and went to a tree, asked the tree to tell him about God. And there were blossoms on the tree, and Francis loved God for those blossoms. And the traditional scholastic theology always said that the good, the true, and the beautiful, in other words, the bonum, the pulchrum, and the verum, as it's called in Latin, are one. These are different sides of God, and I think sometimes that we need to discover again the pulchrum in God and of God, the beauty of God. In modernity, aesthetics was split up completely from religion. And many people think it has nothing to do with these other, but in truth, they are together, and the true and the ethically good and the beautiful belong together. These are simply different sides of the same secret of life which we call God. And we cannot limit ourselves to only one. And we stick absolutely on the verum, the true God. We become orthodox in a sense, and maybe we become even fundamentalist instead of opening ourselves up to these different forms of God. In this story of St. Francis, after the pool, the river, and then the tree, he goes then into the city and meets a beggar, and the empty hands of the beggar tell him about God. And it's a marvelous story about who tells about God, and the thirst of St. Francis to get to know more names of God, and going around like a hiker goes from place to place and wondering about more names of God. I think this is part of this, what I would call our thirst for God or our love for God. I think one of the weaknesses of contemporary Protestantism is that it teaches us a lot about how God loves us and protects us little children who don't know where to go and don't know anything, and are helpless and sad without God, which is true, of course. But it doesn't tell us enough about our love for God. And love is, this is one of the great teachings of contemporary feminism, is always a two-sided thing. It's not that the one is a giver and the other is a taker. It is two-sided, and both, it's mutual. It works only in mutuality. And when we don't learn to love God, then God hasn't loved us. And we haven't received God's love if it doesn't tell us how to love God. And I think to love God, what that means, is part of the whole religious business. And we have to learn that in many new ways. I was helped much in my theologizing through a phrase which I learned from process theologians in this country, California School of Claremont, I think. And they have a phrase which says, God surpasses God, or God transcends God. And I love this very much. It means really that a God who is totally known, when we know all 100 names of Allah, isn't God, because God is always surpassing God's self. is always more than the one we know right now. It's always transcending or growing in one or the other way. So passing, maybe another way to express this. Now let me give you another quote from a great mystic. It's Meister Eckhart, one of my favorites in 13th century in Germany. In the time of these women's movement begins, and he was one of these, the father for many of them, the helper and the mediator between the official church and this sort of resisting or maybe even revolutionary movement of women in that time. And he says, therefore I pray God to rid me of God. It's a wild phrase in a way. To rid me of the God I already know and I have already known, and which the one I take as a property and put it into my pocket. Mm-hmm. He says at some places things like that, that we put God away and put God into a pocket, and that then we can't share God and lose this openness of this God transcends God in whichever way we may understand this. When God is greater than our heart, as Augustine says, we have this all wrong. But I think we have to sharpen our awareness of this fact that God is more than what we know of him, what our dogmatic books say, and we have to invent new stories about God, to tell them, to share them, in order to become more understandable in our world. I think it isn't easy to make ourselves understandable in that sense of a God who is a mix of contradictions, has power, and yet is powerless very often. This is one of the things I struggled almost 25 years of my whole life about. One of the names of God in our tradition, from the Jewish starting point through the whole old church to the Reformation, is this talk of God as being all-powerful, or speaking a little more Latin, as being omnipotent. And the older I was, the more I hated this. Mm-hmm. And couldn't understand it, because it is not to be understood, at least not after the Shoah. If God is sitting in heaven being all-powerful and is able to push some buttons which would change some things, he could have stopped that, those trains, couldn't he? If he is, in that sense, all-powerful. And I've heard a fundamentalist saying such a thing, that Auschwitz was willed by God, otherwise it wouldn't have happened. Everything what happens is willed by God. This is terrible. I can't tolerate that. I have to struggle with these questions, but I don't believe in this superpower father sitting up there and pushing buttons. I think God was very small in the time of Auschwitz, because God had no friends in that country, which is mine. He had no brothers and sisters, no sons and daughters to stop the trains. But God was small. And God is small in our world of hunger and destruction and exploitation and profiting of the few so that the majority is poor. God is small and has no bank accounts. And to say that God is omnipotent and will do all everything, if that is a hope or if that is a prayer, I can understand it. Because there is power in God, I do believe that. But the word omnipotence tells me more about the man who invented such a word. And it's a projection, of course. You don't have to have read much Freud to understand what it means, a man to invent such words. But it isn't enough. It doesn't work. We have to think more about this. And when I understand correctly what Eckhart says with this phrase, therefore I ask God to rid me of God. I ask my mother God to rid me of this type of father God. I wish to be free from this God, because he isn't God. He cannot be love if he is omnipotent and at this time just doesn't need his love or hides it or does whatever he wants with it, I don't know. But I think this concept is not good enough for our understanding of God. We need to understand the power of God as having something to do with God's friends, not being in itself or by itself, or are they, as they call that in Latin, in theology sometimes, something which is absolutely independent. God is not absolutely independent. That's a male ideology. I was always thinking, I learned something here in this culture, the United States, of this story of a young man who goes to with the settlers to a new village, and there's a robber band, and they tyrannize the whole village, and everything falls apart, and the sheriff is helpless, he doesn't know what to do. And this wonderful young man comes up, and he has a better horse, better gun, and I don't know what, brings people together, and they finally get these robbers away. And the daughter of the sheriff falls in love with the young man, and she loves him so much, and he too, and they are going to marry. And then in the early morning, he stands up and saddles his horse and goes west. Independency, the greatest value for a young man, to stay independent. It's a strange myth. I don't recall from whom I read this story first, but it is a strange myth, which really tells you something about male dreams, but nothing about God. God is dependent. God needs us, each of us, everyone. God wishes us to be God's hands, God's feet, God's eyes. Teresa of Avila has this wonderful reproach. She says, God has no other hands than ours. God has no other eyes than ours. When we don't see what is going on, or where the School of Americas is, or what they do there, if we don't publish it, there's no other power to do that. That's ridiculous to believe that. God has no other hands than ours. I sometimes struggle with tradition, sometimes struggle with my husband about this question. Maybe God has more hands than I have, surely. I believe that. But this big we, this long-term we, it's this my grandchildren we, this my ancestors we, this real big we, that is the we in which God hides God's self. And in that sense, we're still on the way to find more names for God. It means also to understand ourselves in this growing union with God, being one with God, which mystics always talked about, being born anew and being the hand of God. I would like to read this poem once more for you. Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth and the oceans, before our little blue planet on which life multiplies through love and union, was born from you after a long pregnancy, you were there waiting for us. You allow cultures to perish when they separate from you and call others into being. What seemed to us 1,000 years and unchanging, the bloody violence, is to you a short watch in the night. Even tyrants break down exhausted. Economic conglomerates dissolve. And the knowledge of infallible parties becomes last year's snow. Slavery was profitable and flourished, but in the evening of your day, it withered. The fruits of armament climbed to the sky, but your anger consumed them, and your wrath will destroy the stolen prosperity. You make known our plundering of the poor. You bring to light our veiled crimes. Days pass away quickly in fear of the truth. We spend our years as if on a drug trip. What I fear is 70 years. In other lands, many will not live even 4 years. Here we push 80 and more. The joy has become stale. Technology drags us along. Who has faith in you, poor God, without nuclear bombs, without banks? And who is afraid when your fish die? Remind us that we are small, dwelling here briefly on borrowed earth. Teach us that we must die and have no time for all the hatred that makes our long-flying planes old. Teach us to number the days in which we think of you and call upon you. Turn your countenance to us, O God. Come to those who watch for you. Satisfy us in the morning with your light, so that we make music and no day is without joy. Make us glad again after all the years of emptiness in the land of looters, where blood cleaves to our bank palaces. Bring us bread and roses, O God. Your splendor is in the hair of children. Let your light be upon us, making it easy for us to come and to go. Help us present your world, preserve your world, and establish the work of our hands, the good work of liberation. Amen.
I have one comment about the omnipotence. I think the way that It was told to me, it was always a struggle to understand that God could be both all-powerful and all-good. And maybe the rationalization was that God also grants us the free will to make our own decisions and doesn't impose God's power on us, so that perhaps the potential is there. As in with ourselves, we have, if you have the faith of a grain of mustard seed, you can move mountains. So that God could also do that with God's power. But like you say, there are such horrible circumstances where God's power did not show itself. But is that because people's will is what really controls things, that the people that can make the decisions?
Yeah, that's a very good explanation of how to... It's a Jewish explanation, actually, that God was all-powerful once upon a time before creation, so to speak, before creating the human beings. And then he withdrew from his own power and gave it to the human, the free will. Mm-hmm. Gave freedom to kill, to rob, to rape, or whatever. And I think that's a good interpretation in which this omnipotence is reduced in a way, mm-hmm. and it makes it clearer to understand what is going on. Another thing which I learned out of Judaism, which I find is wonderful, is the mystical understanding of us becoming one with God, which in Christianity is very often phrased in a loving union, becoming one with God, bridegroom and bride and other symbols. But in the Jewish tradition, it's also talked about that we become one will with God, mm-hmm. so that we will what God wills. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't to obey this, being not a foreign voice who tells me to do this, but I become one will with God. There's this wonderful song, "Breathe on me, breath of God, mm-hmm. fill me with life anew, that I might do what thou wouldst do and will." And then it says something like, "I be one will with you." Mm-hmm. Without reflection or without obeying, it's more than obedience. It's union, mm-hmm. which I spontaneously do what thou wouldst do.
Yeah. One of my pastors said the phrase of putting on the robe of righteousness, one of the Old Testament analogies. And to me, it almost wasn't good enough yet, because a robe still feels outer, you know, like it needs to be that will of the heart within you, a robe for your heart, not outside you.
Yeah, that's true. I learned this, by the way, from Hans Jonas, this Jewish philosopher and theologian as well. Was a Jewish, he was a German philosopher of religion, and then fled, and some of his relatives were cast and in this part of the world. And he has later on in his life spoken to this, all these questions about the Odyssey and how it comes. And he's also talking about this. Is God giving up some of his power?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It raises the question in my mind about prayer, mm-hmm. where in one sense, I am me and God is God, and my need, my desire, my demand, my pleading with God comes from from me.
Yeah.
And yet, in a certain sense, a goal of prayer is for me to pray what God wills.
Yeah.
And I'd be interested in your comment about that in terms of how we seek to align our will entirely with God. How does that relate to prayer?
The mystical tradition talks about a prayer which is infused in us, so that we speak with God's voice and leave our own or immerse our own voice in God's voice, say better. We are a drop in this ocean, and we very often this is not possible, especially in suffering. We are to pray for to become free, but I think the problems are not simply solved. I think in mysticism there sometimes is a wonderful form of, I don't know the word, of the German word is trotz, which is a saying no. If a child says no, I don't go, how you call that?
Stubbornness.
Yeah, I think it's stubborn. And some mystics have a stubbornness in themselves. I have a wonderful story, which is in this old book of mine on suffering, where this is a Jewish story. A man travels with his family on a ship, and the ship sinks, and they come to an unsettled island, and his wife and his two children, they are saved from this break of the ship, but they have nothing to eat and to drink. And then first of all, one child dies, second child dies, and finally his wife dies by hunger and thirst. And then he says something like, oh God, now you think I should curse you, but I tell you, I won't. It's a great story. I've forgotten the wording. You can read it. He doesn't do that. He still clinges to God despite all of what he has been through, and still hopes for God. And I always brought this together with those Jewish people who went into the gas, singing this Shema Israel, not stopping, just going on with an almost, it's almost ununderstandable how someone can be so stubborn, so filled with life for God, which goes beyond what we know of God or what he or she experiences of God. God transcends God in that. And it is, I mean, in small portions we have this very much in our Christian tradition. It's in this cantata of Bach, Jesus, my joy, comes, even in suffering you stay my joy, something like that. This would be the same thing, in a way it's a weaker form of expression, but it's still the same thing. And I think it is hidden in the tradition, but the talk, the all too unquestioned talk about the omnipotence of God has really almost destroyed our ability to critique this, to question it, to struggle with it. And I think we have to learn this anew. And if you think how disrespectful Abraham talks to God, dealing with him like an old fish seller or something in Sodom and Gomorrah, 50 or 30 or 40, how far would you go? Huh? And other stories, I mean, they're wonderful stories which really tell you about an absolute powerless human being dealing with an absolute powerful divine being. That is not, love is empowering and not absolute power versus
consciousness.
Well, there is power in a name, in that we think we own something when we know the name of it.
Yeah.
And we categorize it, box it up, and we usually put it away because we know all there is to know about it, yet we think of I am that I am.
Yeah.
You know, what is your name on I am that I am, or the concept of the word. It's not divine. And yet, you know, Allah has 99 names, but one of them we don't know. Well, Jehovah has one name, and we don't even know what that is.
I couldn't agree more. The naming in itself is always endangered by something which Martin Buber makes this wonderful philosophical understanding that there are two relationships in which each of us stands. One is the I-Thou relationship, in which the other is unknown and can never be owned. And the other relationship is the I-It relationship. And the It, of course, can be known, named, possessed, used, exploited, and whatever. This is our relationship to the earth, is an I-It relationship. We are masters and owners, as Descartes put this. Mm-hmm. Maître possesseur de la nature, I think is one of the most horrifying things you can say about our relationship to nature. Mm-hmm. And we are now in the consequences of that. What that means, when we possess everything, then we deal with it as we do.
We do that with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use that as an it. We did this the same, of course we do it with people. We do it with all our slaves. Mm-hmm. And these new slaves we invent right now before our eyes. The textile industry is for me a new form of slavery. Mm-hmm. It's not in the same form as the old one, but it is. Maybe it's worse than some of the real conditions of agricultural slavery in the south of the United States 200 years ago. And I think and to mix up this, the I-Thou and the I-It, is that's what separates us from God. That's what we call sin. Mm-hmm. To use the thou and make it into an it, which we can exploit and use and name. And it starts with this this complete naming in sense in terms of having a concept of who you are and definition. I mean, a name is still a little bit different from a definition in a strict sense of the word. But it has still some more dimensions beyond the definition.
Maybe we can turn it around, in other words, that the it becomes my thou when I love these things so much that
mm-hmm. What I'm thinking is a sacred relationship with the earth would be an I thou.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It has to be.
Yes.
Sure. This is what we learn from the natural nature religions, or however you call them, of the first peoples here. It's wonderful what they teach us in terms of their humility and seeing it as.
And is that what the shalom means too? To be in harmony with God and your neighbor and yourself? And the neighbor can be, the earth can be, in that dimension.
Yeah.
So you treat all of pieces of that.
Yeah, the earth is not a material which we can use to the way the Native Americans did this, asking trout or some of the fish to take some of them, but never plunder the whole thing and destroy it as we do. There's a strong sense in that which has to do with respect. Maybe those fish have also more names than we give them. In our in our possessive wish to possess and to use.
The fishermen call those fish trash fish.
Yeah.
The ones that they kill and throw back.
Yeah. Mm.
To get the ones that we want to eat.
Yeah. Mm. 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 There's so many things they make into trash. I mean, instead of going along with the recycling system, which Mother the Earth has in herself, as I just recently understood this really, how we have to imitate the recycling system of nature.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the biggest tasks of our world now, to get into this imitation process, to not to eat it up to the last end, but leave something so this will grow again and can grow and bring forward food and so on. And I think in this little poem, I was so shocked about this. I think our wish for an everlasting life sometimes is really in our way to become more holy. I mean, ecofeminism, as I understand it, and I learned this from Rosemary Luther, has to do, among other things, with our giving in into the rhythm of nature. Nature has a rhythm. There is night and day and spring and fall and coldness and warmness and life and death and youth and age. And what technocracy does is to destroy this rhythm. We are talking about the viable spring. You can go everywhere, wherever you want to have spring. If there is no spring in northern Germany or in Norway, so why don't you go, huh? Take a plane, there is spring enough. Everywhere, we are everywhere. That's what globalization means in many terms. And also, if you are old, lift your face and whatever else, I don't know. Why should you be old? There is no such a thing like this rhythm. The earth is something to own and to exploit as the other people are. And we are masters and lords. And I think before we, Christianity has its part in this, with this wish for an everlasting life. I think there's something wrong with that.
Mm. I think it's self-hatred.
It's self-hatred?
I say it's self-hatred. In other words, you do not love what you are, so you want to change it. I don't know that anyone believes in everlasting life in the sense that I will live forever. But I may not like the way my face is, or the way my body is, or the color of my hair,
yeah.
So I can change it. And I think it has a root in self-hatred.
You're not being fulfilled in yourself.
We're not being fulfilled.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of the I am, because we get so preoccupied with I was or I will be. And I think the strength of the I am is that you learn to focus so fully in the present. That idea you said the other day of the presence of God, when you were talking in the other lecture, that we need to rejoice in just the I am of ourselves and everything.
Mm-hmm. So we never learn that we must die.
We just live fully, whatever age we are.
Mm-hmm.
Dying is okay too.
Mm.
Well, I think you hit on something there that's important. Our culture denies death.
Mm-hmm.
We do everything we can. In fact, the people who are dead in the coffin look better than when they were alive.
Yeah, I think one of my anxieties, one of my fears in getting older is that I will be in a hospital and the young assistant doctor has no time on Friday to put me off from all these things. And so they wait until Monday and decide maybe Monday is enough and maybe not. They have even a new technology to exercise out and to try. I have gone through some similar thing with my mother who died, and I was accompanying her into death, and She had an absolute breakdown a year before she died. And then she came to intensive care that put her together again. And then she lived one more year, and she didn't want to. And she told me again and again, or she told, asked the doctor, if I don't take this pill, Mr. Doctor so-and-so, would I die earlier? And he would say, no, my lady, much painful. He was a very wise doctor. And she really wanted to go. It was for me a very deep experience. And then she had a birthday, and my daughter, who is a doctor herself, lives in Bolivia, she wrote to her grandmother. They had a very special relationship because my mother always wanted a doctor in the family. We all didn't do that. So they loved each other. And my daughter writes to her grandmother, I do not wish you another birthday. None of us four children would have said so. Of course, we knew that this was the dream and the wish and the hope of my mother, but we dared not to say. It's very hard to say such a thing in our culture. Mm-hmm. And I was so glad, and my mother immediately calls me up during the day to tell me that. Look, Caroline, she knows what I want. I know too. It is wonderful. I just was happy with that. And then later when I went through this whole thing, there was another experience that she was already in coma and the doctor came and I told him something about painkillers, and he said, yes, yes, or do you think we should put her in a hospital? And my mother, 48 hours in coma, wakes up and yells, no! Not this! I loved her so much when she did this. She was absolutely aware of what was going on. She was great. I have described this whole story in this book, which will forthcome next year. It's called Against the Wind. It is sort of an autobiographical book of mine. It's just translated meanwhile, but not yet out with Fortress Press. And another story is in that. Anyone more? We are kind of, yeah.
As of the church, and we as the church, and we as God's hands, have roles in the present, even in the dying process. My father died 2 years ago, and he was at Fairview in Minneapolis. And I came by a flight. We had pneumonia. And we knew that it was just a matter of time. I came alone as an only child to my dad. My mother had passed. And the hospital set up a cot for me next to my father's bed in the room. Mm-hmm. So that passing process could be one of the present moment and the one of God's hands comforting. Because as you said, God's presence there was through the doctors and through the nurses and through the daughter being there to comfort the father. And so if we keep this beautiful concept and then take it with us and apply it in all our aspects of life, it's going to certainly enrich the experience of God.
That's a wonderful story. It really fits very well to me. Thank you.
That made me look on my own passing in a completely different way.
Yeah. I mean, older cultures have always dealt in a different way with death and dying than we do. In technocracy, take it away from our hands, and we have really to to work on that. It's a big task to do that, to take this back from me too.
It's not completely hopeless. As a chaplain in the hospital a year or so ago, I remember a nurse coming to me and especially and asking me if I had time just to be with this woman who was dying, who didn't have any family there.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, she won't know you. She said, she's not conscious, but she said, I just don't think she should die alone.
Yeah.
So she knew.
She knew.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.